Hello and welcome to Slate Money, the Babies and Burgers edition. Guiding you through the business and finance news of the week, I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion in New York. And on this week's show, we're going to start with some letters sent in by you. We love our mailbag and we love you. Then we'll take on the business of surrogacy. You may be shocked to learn that being paid to bear other people's children is not the most above board of industries. We'll talk about the big labor news this week, the National Labor Board decision that McDonald's might be held responsible for its franchisees. And then, because Argentina just defaulted on its debt again, and it is my favorite subject in the world, we are going to talk about Argentina again. I make no apologies for this. And as ever, we will finish with our regular numbers lightning round. Speaking of which, let me introduce our regular guests. Kathy O'Neill, head of the lead program for data journalism at Columbia. How are you this morning?
I'm great, Felix.
How much sleep have you had in the past 2 nights?
Not that much.
We're going to put everything on you this
week. Awesome,
awesome.
I think well under exhaustion.
But you do have a number.
Of course, I have a number, yes.
Good for you. We're going to have a mystery number from Kathy. Jordan, do you have a number?
I do have a number.
Is your mystery number a mystery number as well?
Kathy, I'll show you mine. Or if you show me yours, I'll show you mine.
I also have a number, which is 66 million, but never mind that. We will start this week with the mailbag. We love it when you send in mail. Matthew Murphy had an interesting question, which he sent to slatemoney@slate.com. Do we think that banks actively calculate on some kind of a spreadsheet whether illegal activity is worth it by comparing the profits from the activity to the expected fine they might end up paying if they get caught and the cost to their reputation and the probability? Do they actually mathematically work this out, Kathy?
My guess is no, but not because they don't want to. They don't do it because what I've learned about data and digitization of records is that it allows people to track things really well and efficiently.
But do they do it in their head?
Yeah.
There's a kind of cost-benefit analysis thing going on?
But of course.
Okay.
I mean, right? If you're like, I'm going to go shoplift, I think there's a cost-benefit analysis. I'm like, well, what are the chances I'm going to get caught and not actually get that thing?
But they are completely conscious of the fact that what they're doing is illegal when they're doing it.
I believe they mostly are.
Because I disagree with that. I think that almost everyone deludes themselves into believing that what they're doing is right and proper at nearly all times.
I can't speak to what's inside the soul of your typical Wall Street banker, unfortunately. But I do think that most of them would have been told by their general counsel that if they even have a hunch that they might need to do a cost benefit along those lines, for the love of God, don't put it in writing or on our systems anywhere. Because if you want a smoking gun, yeah, I mean, like that's totally it.
I want the spreadsheet that has a column called probability of getting caught.
We also had an interesting question from Michael Kelsey about tax reform. We got a lot of mail about tax reform, and Michael Kelsey asked probably the most basic question. I'm going to start with you, Jordan. If you could pass any single tax reform you wanted, which one would it be?
Any single tax reform I wanted, which one would it be?
I can answer this.
Go on, Kathy.
Raise capital gains.
Raise the capital gains tax. You see, I was going to say something similar. Raise the capital gains tax to the level of the income tax.
That's right.
So they're exactly the same.
I don't know if I'd raise it that high. You know, right now, I think the one I would go for is a 0.1% tax on a 0.1% tax on wealth, like the
wealth tax.
Yeah, a wealth tax for people who have over $20 million essentially in assets.
Also, I think maybe a financial transactions tax does almost no harm and quite a lot of good, and it would more or less wipe out high frequency trading at a stroke, which would be no bad thing, and would generate revenue. But there's lots of taxes which are good. Carbon taxes are good.
Yeah, well, that one's wonderful.
It's not really tax reform, is it?
Beyond the realm of imagination.
I did want to mention that I spent some time with a friend of mine who's an expert on tax law this week talking about the inversion stuff. And like literally the more I know about it, the more complicated it is. So when people – I do want to make the mention that when people say close the loophole on tax inversion, they are not talking about an actual thing.
Which is also one of the reasons why if we're talking about tax reform, big, simple taxes, like a wealth... Well, a wealth tax wouldn't be simple, but a carbon tax could be relatively simple. A financial transactions tax could be relatively simple and similar, what are known as Pigovian taxes, where you tax the things you don't want.
Yeah.
But if you want to get really technical and complicated, my one is that I would like to abolish the tax deductibility of interest payments.
For mortgages? Or just all interest, yes.
All interest.
Yeah.
Including mortgages,
oh, that's
but
a good
in
one.
General for everything.
Oh, it's a really good one, yes. you have to be pretty nerdy to know why that's so good.
Maybe next week we'll talk about that, but I'll tell you who else. Not only is Cathy O'Neill a fan of this, but the other person who's a fan of this? Paul Volcker.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Little known fact. Anyway, Cathy, let's move on to topic number one, which is something to do with babies. Tell us about babies.
Okay, so there's a guy named Rudy Rupak, who, by the way, is an ex-CTO of American Apparel, just by the way, who has gotten in trouble recently for promising to help people have babies through what's called gestational surrogacy, and then not actually delivering on that promise. And he's taken a lot of money from a lot of people. I mean, I don't know if it's in the millions, but it's around that. Basically, gestational surrogacy is when I'll just do the standard version, and then there's lots of variations, but it's when a woman and a man decide they want a baby, but they can't gestate the baby. So they donate the egg or the sperm or both and make a little thing, which they give to another woman who then brings the baby to term. There's a word for that, which I have...
A zygote?
Yes. Maybe it's called a zygote. And so, okay, lots of issues here, right? Legal issues, ethical issues. And like legally speaking, it's all over the map. Even in the United States, every state has a different law about this. Like California, Illinois, and Nevada are the only three states that have well-defined rules about this. Almost every other state has some kind of confused thing. And the reason it's so confusing is because things happen when this happens. Like this is not a new idea, although it's much bigger than it used to be. And it's going to get even bigger, I claim. I'll say that why in a second. But you have things like this woman, you know, carried a baby to term. And then at the end of the day, when the baby was born, she's like, I don't want to give this up. And I'm the mother. And then so it comes to the sort of technical legal definition of motherhood, which is interesting.
Because, yeah, the question is the person who gave birth to the baby the mother? And the obvious answer to that is, duh, yes. But then legally and morally and financially, that's not maybe the case. And one of the consequences of the very complex set of regulations and permits and so forth in the United States is that many American couples wind up using surrogates in Mexico or in India rather than in the US because there's much less red tape if you do that. But then, of course, it becomes even more open to abuse and to people like your man Rudy.
Rudy, yeah. Well, Rudy. Actually, he has more than one name. And he also has 150 different domain names for his business, which at the end of the day, he said, this is not fraud. This is just mismanagement. I'm terrible about contracts. But he managed to get all those contracts done. Yeah, there's a bunch of different issues. Let me just throw out one. There's a spectrum of shadiness to this whole thing. On the one hand, you have like people who really want kids but can't have kids. And they're like, oh, my God, I need help. And can I pay your expenses if you're willing to have my kid for me? And there's a free woman who decides this is what I want to do because I love being pregnant or whatever reason. And it seems like a perfectly reasonable interaction and negotiation. And on the other side, you have like literally baby selling. So like another thing that was mentioned is that there are these clinics that pop up. And it's important to realize that every single part of this transaction is now a commodity. You can buy eggs. You can buy sperm. Then you can pay people, women often in India, to get pregnant and then have this baby. So at the end of the day, you could, and this actually happens, claim that they have adoptive parents who have ordered this, who have begged them for children, but they don't. And then they have these babies and they're selling them. So that's like the other super far end of the spectrum. You're literally having baby selling.
So yeah, I think that this is the kind of issue where it kind of begs for some global standards. I hate to like say world government, but like, you know, one of the things that's driving people to operations like this one that kind of is now in bankruptcy and it seems like may have been defrauding people is that it's very expensive to get a surrogate in the United States if you want to do it right. I mean, they're very well-regarded, reputable services. They do it for like $20,000, $30,000. It's expensive in the U.S. That's what red tape gets you. You're paying $30,000 at least as a fee to the people.
I mean, I think it is cheaper in Mexico and India, but I don't think this is a sort of race to the bottom in terms of costs. I think the reason people do it in those countries is just because it's easier more than because it's cheaper.
Let me throw in another thing, though. I mean, and this is more ethical than legal, it's not just red tape, right? It's a question of whether the woman actually chose to do this. You know, you have less choice as a woman living in rural India and you're impoverished. Like, you don't feel like, oh, yeah, I love having babies. I'm going to do this for this couple I really like. It's more like, I have to do this. You know, and this is going to pay the bills.
And this, I mean, this is all related to, for instance, the debate about whether people should be allowed to sell their kidneys to someone who needs a kidney. And the reason why maybe that's not such a good idea is precisely that people who don't really want to but who are desperate for money for whatever reason will wind up feeling like it's their only choice, and that's not a world that we really want to live in.
On the other hand, you still have it happening. You know, I mean, it's still...
Right. It's happening more and more. And like, it's hard to actually follow the numbers here because it's not reported anywhere centrally. But if you follow the sort of number of clinics, then you'll see that this is growing, so we're doubling in size in the last decade.
And so I guess, yeah, again, that's why I feel like there should be some kind of accord, because at least in the United States... Some kind of accord. Sorry.
Accord?
Yeah. I mean, it'd be great if there was some sort of treaty on this between countries. I mean, I don't see why
Treaty. Oh, a treaty. I am literally not understanding any word you are
You're
saying.
You're literally...
There's a core and a tree. What are these cores and trees? You mean an accord in the treaty?
Well, Felix, okay. I will tell you about the cord in the treaty. no, but seriously, I feel like there should be... For something where you have wealthy people from around the world shopping for where they can most easily have a woman get pregnant on their behalf and the problems that creates, I think that requires some global coordination if you ever actually want to deal with the potential downsides and potential problems. If you don't, if you try to do it country by country basis, you're always just going to be kind of playing whack-a-mole, you know?
I totally agree. And things get really shady, obviously. And the more opacity there is and the farther away it is, the more likely you have people who are just like, make babies for me. I'm going to sell them.
So maybe there needs to be like a worldwide treaty on like body selling.
You see, I'm highly skeptical about all of this. I think this is part of what makes countries different, is they just have unbelievably different attitudes to this kind of thing. There's absolutely no way that you're ever going to get, you know, 100 different countries on the same page when it comes to this. I think the one thing you might be able to do is just set up, you know, under the auspices of the World Health Organization or something like that, a centralized database of, you know, everyone who's doing this. So at least we can start measuring it and counting it and find out how prevalent it is. And
you're right, Felix. It's not only different, like how people's attitudes, but the reasons it's happening. Like this country, I'm 42. I'm pretty much the only friend of mine of my age who has kids. Like it's amazing how many people in my generation are going to be asking for in vitro fertilization or some sort of thing in the next 10 years. It's just going to be huge in this country, not in India. They're not like, oh, where's my baby?
Although the trend of women having babies later and later is a global trend.
It
and
is.
It's even stronger in places like Italy than it is in
the
U.S.
That's true.
Enough of these babies. We're going to move on to McDonald's because, you know what, there's no way that we can wind up on world government accords or treaties or anything else. Jordan, what has been going on at Mackey D's?
Well, you see, the New World Order. So this week, the NLRB's General Counsel, the National Labor Relations Board.
National Labor Relations Board.
It's like the chief labor agent. When a union wants to certify or there are complaints about what companies are treating workers, it usually goes to the NLRB.
Which was established after the Great Depression.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the chief labor agency in the United States. Its general counsel concluded this week that McDonald's is a joint employer of all of its franchise's employees, its franchise's workers, all the people cooking burgers, you know, making the fries, manning the cashiers, that not only is the franchise owner the employer, but also McDonald's is a joint employer. And this sounds like a small technical issue, but in fact, it is a massive, massive deal for labor in the United States, because all sorts of things about whether or not McDonald's can be held liable for the behavior of its franchises, and most of the McDonald's restaurants you go to in the United States our franchises are determined by whether or not you consider it the employer. McDonald's likes to say, you know, we license our franchises with a, you know, they pay us for the right to run a McDonald's restaurant. You know, we sell them the burgers, we do their marketing, but in the end, they are independent businessmen who are in charge of their how they treat their employees. The essentially this you know the worker advocates say no, that's not the case. McDonald's exerts all sorts of control over how they're paid, how they're managed in subtle and some not so subtle ways. And now this labor agency says, yes, we agree with the workers. And this decision is going to impact a whole bunch of administrative hearings and all sorts of complaints against McDonald's.
But this decision,
and it's going to go to the courts,
is
eventually
not final.
And that's the key thing. Eventually, this will probably get decided in a federal appeals court or possibly maybe one day the Supreme Court. And this is, I think, what's interesting to me about, most interesting to me about this, and there are all sorts of angles, though, is that it looks like organized labor has finally found an avenue in which it can actually, without directly organizing workers at these franchises, to actually make a difference by bringing these complaints and fueling these strikes that essentially led to this decision, and get some sort of legal change. It's managing to, rather than organize people, sort of become an advocacy group.
Yeah, so the SEIU was part of this battle, and they have actually been organizing fast food workers. The something-something-something.
Service Employees International Union.
Oh, thank
big
you.
Big union, yes. Yeah. Of... They would like to unionize burger flippers, but because of the franchise system, they find it very hard.
Right. So it should be said that 90% of McDonald's are franchises. So McDonald's doesn't think of its employees as the people that are actually flipping burgers. It thinks, okay, the people that work for us are the franchise owners. And I have a couple of things to say. I have to say I have an inside link here because my friend Mark Barenberg is a labor law professor at Columbia, and he and a couple other people at Columbia have been helping the SEIU on this case. So I got to talk to Mark Barenberg last night, and he showed me the complaint that these guys at Columbia made. And it basically explains the level of control that McDonald's, the parent company, has over these franchises. So there's something called the Hamburger University.
Yes.
All the franchise owners get trained at the Hamburger University, where they get told exactly how everything has to happen to the most minute detail. And they get a manual called the QSC manual, which stands for Quality, Service, and Cleanliness, which explains in more detail all the requirements of, like, this is how big a patty is, this is how many patties should be able to be made in 3 minutes, all the requirements for the quality and the cleanliness, and then strongly worded suggestions and recommendations for service. So that it's clear that if you read this manual, that McDonald's has explicitly made it seem like they have complete control over everything, but they're not actually telling you how to.
Wait, so hang on. I mean, let me just stop here because I feel like we're litigating the case here, and I feel like there's no one who's defending McDonald's. So let's just jump forwards a minute and say, let's assume that this case against McDonald's is strong and they are a co-employer. You know, the question is, what are the chances that this decision is going to hold up in appeal and all the way up through various levels of appeal? And if it does, is it actually going to change the lives of burger flippers?
Only the general counsel has made this, right? They have to vote on it in the NLRB, but it's a 5-person voting group, and the 3 of them are appointed by Obama. They think it's going to pass. That doesn't mean it's not going to be appealed or overturned. And obviously, the business world is not happy about this idea because a lot of people structure these subsidiaries in various ways to keep themselves at arm's length.
This is everything old is new again, you know, because this is exactly the same argument that Uber loves to make about its drivers. You know,
yes.
They're not employees. They're sole contractors.
McDonald's is, though, an extreme case. So I just want to say the manual I was talking about, also they have something called the shift management manual. Very, very, very precise directions where other companies don't do it that much. So it could be a case where McDonald's actually does get in trouble for this, but other companies don't.
Yeah, there's an example. So I think that to your question of what's the chance of this holding up, I don't think it's great. If it ever made it to the Supreme Court, I think Anthony Kennedy would just kind of look at it and go, you got to be kidding me. I mean, it just, you know, it's an extremely pro-corporate court. I have a hard time imagining a 5-judge majority forming and saying, yes, let's uphold this ruling that would change the way fast food restaurants work forever. However,
or would it? If it holds up, it
changes a lot. Because
McDonald's has its own restaurants. I mean, they might only be 10%. You know, why would it change that much?
It does change. First off, it might change the ability of unions to actually go straight to McDonald's and try to organize workers in certain regions or whatnot, rather than just having to go franchise by franchise by franchise.
It changes basically their ability to create a union. And then once they have a union, they can negotiate
more. So it at least opens up these sorts of things. But, you know, I think there's also a technology story going on here that is really worth bringing up, because one of McDonald's big arguments, or really the entire restaurant industry's big arguments you've heard, is that this is a radical departure, quote unquote. That's the language, a radical departure from precedent. And I think the response to that, and the, you know, the unions and the workers bringing these challenges have said it, but from what I've seen from some lawsuits, it seems credible, is that technology really has changed the degree of control that companies like McDonald's have. They can literally monitor how many people are working in real time, how much they're being paid, and how much their pay is as a percentage of sales, and whether or not that's going over a certain limit. And if so, then they have to essentially, you know, the franchises are encouraged to cut down the number of workers or
I mean, I think what we should say is the technology has tipped the balance between capital and labor. One of the problems about working at McDonald's is that increasingly you can get called up to a shift on very short notice. And if you don't turn up to that shift, then you're fired because you haven't turned up to work, which means that even if you're not working many hours per week, you still can only work one job because you need to be available the whole time. And that technology of like trying to keep a larger number of people working fewer hours didn't really exist to the same degree that it does now. And so I think, yeah, to Jordan's point, this is a change. And, well, you know, it'll be a very long time, I think, before it results in any actual change in the world, because it will be appealed. But we can but hope. And we will leave McDonald's there, because we do need to move on to my favorite subject in the world.
We must.
Hey, Felix, tell us what's going on with Argentina.
Thank you, Kathy, for asking me that very good question. I'm very happy you asked me that. I will tell you what's happening in Argentina. Argentina has defaulted, officially.
Wow.
It has happened.
Woo! Do we have a gong or something for that?
we will insert gong sound here. The unthinkable... Well, it really wasn't unthinkable. People have been thinking about this for years. has happened. This is a big deal in the world of sovereign debt geeks, and I count myself proudly among their number. We have a very large country with a very large amount of debt. And the interesting thing about this default is that Argentina has actually paid the money. It wrote the check, and it sent the money to the Bank of New York, which is the trustee for the bondholders, and said, hey, Bank of New York, here's our coupon payment. Give it to the bondholders. And it's not Argentina's fault, really, that the Bank of New York has been enjoined by U.S. courts from actually doing that. So the money is now just sitting there gathering dust at Bank of New York. Gathering dust, by the way, being a technical term, it is not gathering interest at a statutory rate of 8 or 9%, which is what the exchange bondholders are going to require
Felix,
to cure the default.
Can we back up for a second?
Yes.
Which check did they cut?
The coupon payment to their bondholders.
So what? Explain why that's being held.
And that is being held because there is a judge in the federal court in New York, an 83-year-old chap named Thomas Grisey, who has been hearing this case for well over a decade and eventually got fed up with Argentina and said, okay, Argentina, I'm not even going to let you pay your bondholders. I'm going to create this remedy, this injunction, which prevents you from paying your bondholders unless you pay off these vulture funds, these hedge funds, the money that they're owed.
Right. The vulture fund, headed by one fabulously wealthy American.
Paul Singer.
Yes. And so that fabulously wealthy American has used his influence to prevent a bunch of other bondholders from getting paid, as well as putting Argentina in a terrible position. I'd like to ask you this question.
And although, to be honest, you know, I'm not completely convinced, and I have a piece up at Slate about this, how terrible Argentina's position really is as a result of this. In most cases, sovereign default is a very big deal, and it results in the collapse of the currency and the collapse of the government and a major recession and, you know, these kind of things. In Argentina, because they have the money, because they have the willingness to pay, because they have not had any access to international markets for well over a decade anyway, I'm not convinced that it's as big of a deal.
Here's my, like, Occupy question, okay? How is this different from some poor guy who just is being individual, being hounded by a really obnoxious debt collector? and their credit score is being killed, and they're just go away, debt collector. It's like at some level,
it's basically exactly like that.
So our sympathies can be with Argentina.
Except for the debt collector in this case has extremely expensive lawyers and is willing to spend tens of millions of dollars on lawyers to not go away.
And it's like Argentina is like, look, I went to bankruptcy court. I tried to declare bankruptcy. And I tried to pay you guys off, and you're just not leaving me alone, and you're not letting me get on with my life. And I'm just like, there should be a way for this country to move on. And
I forget how much is Singer owed? Like, how much money does he actually
have? $1.5 billion.
That's with interest, right?
How much is he worth?
Then there's also, he's worth much more than that. and then on top of that, there's another, call it, $13 billion of other holdouts who will surely get paid if Elliot gets paid.
Oh, okay.
And then if they get paid, there's this thing called the RUFO clause, the Rights Upon Future Offers clause, which Argentina says would mean that they would have to pay all of the exchange bondholders, all of the rest of their bondholders, $200 million. No one really believes that. Let me, for the sake of being fair to Paul Singer, who I know, actually, I've met him, I've talked to him a few times, what he says is not on its face unreasonable. You know, he has a debt under New York law, under which Argentina has promised to pay him a certain amount of money with certain, you know, interest if it goes into default. He has a contract written under New York. Argentina waived sovereign immunity in that contract. He has every right to go to court in New York and to get a judgment and try and get paid in New York. Even Argentina admits all of this. Argentina happily admits that it owes Paul Singer this money. So the only question here is whether the New York courts can and should prevent Argentina from paying everyone else in an attempt to force Argentina to pay these so-called vulture funds. There is no dispute about the fact that this is a genuine debt which is genuinely owed by Argentina to the funds.
Out of curiosity, so if Argentina hasn't had access to international markets for basically a decade now, is it just domestic debt? How does it work?
Yeah, I mean, as my colleague Ben Edwards at Euromoney magazine once famously started an article, the world is becoming increasingly global. and what that means is that if Argentina can't borrow money from Americans in New York, it will just borrow money from Americans in Buenos Aires. Okay. And there are lots of emerging market funds, mutual funds, investment funds, who will simply buy Argentine bonds in Argentina. And those Argentine bonds in Argentina are paying. They're performing.
So is that why Argentina is basically all right? Because that's not going to stop.
That doesn't stop. And so, you know, you're just essentially just moving the jurisdiction of the place where you can borrow money. And now it's true that Argentina, if it could borrow in New York, it could borrow more cheaply in New York. It could borrow more money in New York. So it's a little bit constrained as to how much of a deficit it can run without just printing money to cover the deficit. And so, therefore, that is what it has done. It started printing money to cover the deficit. And as a result of that, it's suffering from massive inflation. And as a result of the inflation, it's suffering from massive unemployment. And as a result of massive unemployment, it's suffering from, you know, a very low popularity rating for the president. And so all of these things are bad for Argentina. And Argentina is in a bad economic situation right now. It has unemployment of 25%. And that is partly, only partly, but partly a result of the fact that it has no access to international capital markets. So if it dealt with this case, it could probably help itself. But the fact is that it had every opportunity to deal with this case for years and years and years. And it chose not to. And the same calculus pretty much applies now as applied last year or 2 years ago.
Could Argentina fix its fundamental issues or kind of fix its unemployment problem and fix its inflation problem without dealing with this case and with this debt?
I would say that, and I'm not the biggest expert on this, but I would say that it's almost impossible to find an example of an isolated economy which is cut off from international markets, which is also strong and growing and, low unemployment. It can happen for short amounts of time. And, you know, to us, maybe you could say that even China has done it to a certain degree. You know, there's not a huge amount of financial flows as opposed to trade flows in and out of China. But I would say that the chances are that when the Kirchner government finally ends in October 2015, which is a long way away, then the new government will say, okay, we really need to just come to a deal and deal with
it. Well, what are they going to do, though? What deal?
Well, now, right now, they have not just the holdouts in default, not just the vultures in default, but everyone in default. So they're going to have to cure the default to the exchange bondholders. They're going to, as part of doing that, they're going to have to come to some kind of a deal with Thomas Grisey or the vulture funds. No one knows exactly how they're going to do it. It's going to be messy, but it's going...
It's already messy. I just want to number, not my number, but 41 million Argentinians won American here. It is mind-blowing the extent to which this one guy has leveraged the legal system in this country, in New York State, in fact, I believe, to such a degree.
Yeah, I guess
hold ransom those people.
The reason I was asking those questions is because I think there's a fine distinction to make, which is this default, like you said, is kind of no big deal. It's like the default is not going to change the world. It's not apocalyptic. However, this whole situation for Argentina, it seems like you're saying, is a big deal. It's not as if they can just keep marching on without having to worry about it. I mean, eventually they will have to come to terms with it.
Although they've been marching on for much longer than anyone thought that they could do. These things last longer than you think they can. We will leave Argentina for this week. I'm sure we will return at some future point because this is a story which never ends. But I think we'll move on to the numbers. It's time for our numbers round, and I'm going to start with me. Why not? Because I'm in charge. my number is $66 million. It's a dollar amount, and it is the amount that was paid to the African franchise, you might say, of Al-Qaeda in ransom payments last year alone. Total ransom payments over the past few years have reached about at least $125 million. These numbers are coming from an astonishing article by Rukmini Kalimachi in the New York Times. She used to be the AP West Africa Bureau Chief. She's done this amazing reporting, and she has found that European countries, especially France, but also Austria, Germany, Italy, Scandinavian countries, regularly, happily write 10 million euro checks per person, per hostage taken by Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. And this is funding most of the organization. This is actually funding a good 50% of the Al-Qaeda budget in the region. And it's very, very scary. And you can see both sides. If, you know, there was this one poor British chap who got kidnapped with a bunch of Austrians because he lived in Austria and was on holiday with a bunch of Austrians. And the Austrians all got ransomed out, and he got killed. So we don't really want that either. But the fact that the British and the US governments refuse to pay ransoms does mean that they don't tend to kidnap US and UK nationals.
Wow. That's really interesting. Because you hear about that, like, we don't do this with hostages. But, like, it's actually a pretty long-term feedback loop, like, vision to not do that. And that's interesting. So my number is 440,000, which is the approximate number of McDonald's workers. And I just...
Will, come here. You can't have a number which is the same,
you know what,
as a segment.
I just wanted to sort of understand the scope. Hey, I can do whatever I want.
Okay.
It's my number.
Okay.
Kathy is going to be Kathy. She's going to... You do you, Kathy.
I wanted to understand the scope of this McDonald's ruling, because if it gets upheld even just for McDonald's, that's about 1 in 600 people in the United States, but it's, you know, 1 in, like, maybe, say, 300 people who are actually working. So, I mean, it's actually a non-trivial number of people that this ruling affects, and I'm really happy about the ruling.
I just want to think about that for a second. 1 in 300 people working in the United States works for a McDonald's?
That's what I'm saying. It's just a ballpark figure, yes.
Roughly. All right. Well, then.
But they don't work for McDonald's. Not yet. Not until this ruling gets upheld.
Touché. Okay. So my number, it's a sad number, is 20%, which is how much poorer the median American household is, or how much less it's worth than in 1984, according to a report by the Russell Sage Foundation that's been getting a bunch of, press lately. And, of course, the reasons for that, I'm sure we're all aware by now, are housing prices kind of collapsed and a lot of people took on quite a bit of debt.
Housing prices can't be down since 1984.
No, but between housing prices having collapsed from the peak and the amount of debt people still are shouldering, net worth is still down below, for the median household, is still down below 1984 levels. Here was the especially depressing part of when I saw that report. A few years ago, a professor at New York University named Edward Wolfe calculated that in 2010, the median household's net worth was actually lower than in 1969, in the middle of the recession, essentially. That's how far net worth had fallen for the typical American family.
Progress. We've moved up from...
No, we have. We might not have, because the Russell Sage Foundation's report shows that since 2010, there has been no improvement for the median family. So it's quite possible that actually we are still below 1969 levels. However, they use two different data sets, so I can't say affirmatively that we are actually still in the age of Aquarius.
Well, all the median wage graphs I've seen, just like it just hits like a spot in 1980, actually is the year where it just flattens out.
Yeah. Well, this is also median net worth that I just want to clarify for listeners. So net worth is, you know, it's how much you have in assets minus your debts.
Yeah. So people stop making more money, but debts, they stop spending more money.
And they did start borrowing more money.
That's
right. 1980 was the point at which personal debt started skyrocketing, and also mortgages, because that was the beginning of the housing boom. Anyway, that's it for this week. It's been a monster Slate Money. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, then please subscribe. Just search for Slate Money in the iTunes store. And if you've already subscribed and want to have the wonders of Slate Money shared with your friends, then leave a review. It is more helpful than you could possibly imagine. Do please continue to write to us with questions and complaints and suggestions, and we will feature some of those emails because they're awesome. SlateMoney@slate.com is the address. Our producers for Slate Money are Stan Alcorn and Tracy Samuelson. The executive producer of Slate's podcasts is Andy Bowers. For Kathy O'Neill and Jordan Weissman, I'm Felix Salmon. We'll talk to you next week on Slate Money.